It's here and now. In a moment, will Democrats tighten the purse strings for the Iraq war? But first, a stem cell without ethical dilemmas? Researchers at Wake Forest and Harvard universities have discovered a type of stem cell in the amniotic fluid of pregnant women that has many of the same traits as the controversial embryonic stem cell. Opponents of embryonic stem cell research object to the embryo being destroyed in order to obtain the stem cell within, but amniotic stem cells can be harvested during routine testing of pregnant women. Stem cells in general are coveted because they can morph into tissue that can potentially treat spinal cord injuries and illnesses. Well, joining us on the line with more is the leader of the study on amniotic stem cells, Dr. Anthony Atala of the Institute for Regenerative Medicine at Wake Forest University. And Dr. Atala, tell us more about where these amniotic cells are found.
We actually found these cells in the amniotic fluid, which is the fluid that surrounds the baby while the mom is carrying the baby in the womb. And we also found the cells in the placenta, which is the tissue that surrounds both the fluid and the baby. So you can actually obtain the cells either while the baby is still in the womb through the fluid, or wait until the baby is born through the afterbirth, which is called the placenta.
Tell us about what these cells do.
Well, basically, the cells are very similar to human embryonic stem cells in terms of their growth potential. They double in number every 36 hours. And we can then get the cells to grow into nerves, bone, liver, cartilage, fat, blood vessels, and other tissue types in the laboratory.
We understand from some reporting that these amniotic cells don't grow tumors as often as embryonic stem cells do.
Yeah, that was a surprise to us. When we placed them in tissue, they would not form tumors. And in retrospect, it makes sense because the cells are further down the line in terms of development. We're getting the cells at about 10 weeks of gestation as opposed to the first few days of life.
I'm thinking every pregnant woman could have this test and then have what, a bank for future use for her child?
There are two ways that these cells could be used. Either they can be preserved for self-use for that baby's lifetime, or one could start a bank. Theoretically, a bank of approximately 100,000 specimens would be able to provide 99% of the U.S. population with a perfect genetic match for transplantation.
Well, as you know, for years, new parents have had doctors freeze the umbilical cord blood of new babies so that it can be used in the future if needed for leukemia treatments. Is this that same kind of thinking? And by the way, would that umbilical cord that's already frozen have this same cell material in it?
Yeah, the umbilical cord that's currently frozen does not have this particular cell type. And the challenge we've had with umbilical cord, of course, is that you only get the cells that are present within that cord. So the cells really don't expand much after that. Whereas these cells, they can double in number every 36 hours, so they are more amenable for other types of therapy outside leukemia.
Doctor, thanks so much.
A pleasure to be with you.
That was Dr. Anthony Atala, the leader of the study on amniotic stem cells at the Institute for Regenerative Medicine at Wake Forest University. Well, we now turn to Washington Post medical and science reporter Rick Weiss. Rick, first of all, what sort of hope do these amniotic stem cells hold for people? What sort of potential do they have?
For newborns who are born with birth defects, no small number every year, you can imagine now getting some cells while the pregnancy is still going on, building up some tissues that may be helpful to this kid when he or she is born, and having them ready to go for transplantation right after birth, which can be a real benefit instead of waiting for weeks. But in the longer term, you could imagine these cells being in banks just as a way to grow new tissues or even organs for people who have diseases of various parts of the body, need replacement cells for diabetes or liver problems and so on.
What other problems might this address?
Parkinson's disease, for example, where you have neural cells in the brain disappearing, you can imagine transplanting them. And in fact, Dr. Atala did inject some of these cells into mice with brain lesions, and they seem to fill in the space and start to make connections with new brain cells. So that's a possibility. Spinal cord injuries are also talked about a lot.
What sort of criticism might there be?
I think the criticism from longtime proponents of embryonic stem cells is that these cells can't do everything that an embryonic stem cell can do. Embryonic stem cells can turn into literally every kind of tissue in the body. They come from an embryo. You know that an embryo becomes a person. You know they can become any kind of tissue you want. The amniotic stem cells appear to be a little bit more limited at this point.
Rick, what's the difference between these amniotic cells and the adult cells that people who are critics of embryonic cells have embraced in the past?
Right. Well, adult cells can do even less than an amniotic cell, and an amniotic cell can probably do less than an embryonic cell. The idea is that the more these cells mature, the more specialized they become, and the less versatility they have. So the trick is to find the right cell for the right disease that can do what you want it to do without causing problems.
Well, newly sworn-in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has promised to pass a bill expanding federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. President Bush limited federal funding for those embryonic stem cells in 2001, allowing funding only for a few cell lines that were created before that year. But what does this discovery of these amniotic stem cells mean for that debate in Congress?
Every time there's a discovery of a new kind of cell that can do a lot of what an embryonic stem cell can do, it hurts the cause for those who are pushing for more funding for embryonic stem cell research, perhaps unfairly, but that's the way politics works.
Rick Weiss, medical and science reporter for The Washington Post, speaking to us about a new type of stem cell found in the amniotic fluid of pregnant women. Rick, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, embryonic stem cell research legislation is just one item on the agenda this week, a big week for Congress and the White House. Starting tomorrow, Democrats will lead their first hearings on the war in Iraq. And first on their agenda is the president's plan to increase troops and money in Iraq. On Face the Nation yesterday, House Speaker Pelosi said Democrats will not cut off money for troops already in Iraq. But Pelosi said the president should not expect a blank check for future war plans.
We will always be there to protect our troops and to support our troops. The burden is on the president to justify any additional resources for a mission.
Well, joining us on the line now from Washington is John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and a Wall Street Journal columnist, and a guest on Meet the Press yesterday, where the president's expected plan to increase troops in Iraq was passionately debated by Democrat Joe Biden and Republican Lindsey Graham. But, John, this is not just a debate between the parties. This is a debate within the parties, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And Joe Biden took a different stance than Nancy Pelosi did yesterday. Nancy Pelosi raised the possibility of cutting off funds prospectively for additional troops in Iraq. Joe Biden says you can't micromanage and tie the hands of the commander-in-chief. So one of the things that's going to happen, in addition to the flak the president faces, is internal flak in the Democratic Party. The base very much wants this war stopped and stopped now. But people who have a more pragmatic bent, who are more moderate, some of whom want to run for president, may be loath to take that step.
Joe Biden, by the way, who announced he's running for president yesterday on Meet the Press, also said that there's no way to say, Mr. President, stop. He said constitutionally, one can't do that. Is that true?
Well, constitutionally, the Congress can. The question is, can it be effective? It was done, of course, during the Vietnam War, when President Nixon had been weakened by Watergate and left office. The Democratic Congress cut off funding for the war, and then we ended up with those iconic images of helicopters leaving the roofs in Saigon, and the United States finally pulled out for good. But Democrats have been dogged ever since then by the impression among some Americans, and Americans who count in election campaigns, that they are not strong on defense, and they're very worried about avoiding that particular label. So they're going to try to figure out some consensus within the party on exactly what to do, how to deter the president. Ted Kennedy's going to be speaking about on this out on this week. He says he's going to make a major speech about how to stop President Bush.
Biden pointing out that the Democrats and others had voted for the right for Mr. Bush to go to war, and so constitutionally they had to support it.
Yes, although they don't have to continue supporting it. And one of the things that's also been raised is the issue of whether Congress would debate a new war resolution. You know, the circumstances that were believed to obtain in the fall of 2002, when the Congress, then controlled by Republicans, voted to authorize this war, don't exist anymore. We've, among other things, Saddam Hussein is gone. The war was in part to remove him. The weapons of mass destruction that many people thought were there were not there. And some people have debated as a way to deter the president bringing up a new resolution to say, in this circumstance we're in now, which many call a civil war, do we need a new authorization to continue the commitment of American force and the expenditure of huge sums of money, including more than $8 billion a month, which we've been spending?
How likely is that?
I think that is not the likeliest course of events, but some people have raised that possibility, including John Warner, the Republican who formerly chaired the Armed Services Committee before Republicans lost control of the Senate.
Well, you mentioned the Republicans. What kind of debate is there within that party?
Well, we've already seen about a half dozen Republicans in a reasonably high-profile way. Chuck Hagel from Nebraska, Gordon Smith from Oregon, Susan Collins of Maine stand up and say, we cannot go along with additional troops in Iraq. The White House believes that they will lose a few more, especially those Republicans up for election in 2008. But they think at the end of the day that the vast majority of Republicans will go along, some Democrats will go along, and that they'll ultimately be able to attempt this new strategy the president's outlining. And then the question is going to be, does it have a chance of working better than the old strategies have worked?
Well, and besides increasing troops and funding in Iraq, the president is also reportedly going to set some benchmarks for the Iraqi government to meet. We're going to speak in a moment with a military expert who's written about those benchmarks. But what's the sense in Washington that the war can be won politically? In other words, some of the benchmarks are supposed to be having elections for the Sunnis, getting the current government to arrest and detain more of the militia members. What is the sense that, you know, that might work?
Well, first of all, if you go outside the White House, talk to people in both parties, pessimism is very high about where this Iraq venture is headed. The question is, what's the least bad of the options? And the Baker Commission, which reported in December, the president does not seem particularly impressed with their report, talked about moving more toward a diplomatic political solution, wider solution for the region, engaging Iran and Syria in a discussion. Most people think the best shot we have of avoiding a catastrophe there involves some sort of political accommodation, bringing the Sunnis in, an equitable division of oil revenues. Now, part of that, of course, is going to be in the president's plan as well. The question is there a stomach for more troops as part of a move toward political resolution?
And one last thought from you, John. That's not all that's going on this week. Congress has also planned votes on enacting the 9/11 Commission recommendations, on increasing the minimum wage, on increasing federal funding for stem cell research, as we mentioned, on allowing the government to negotiate lower Medicare drug prices. Do you think the Democrats are going to be able to stay on track with this heavy agenda, with no less than the future of the war in Iraq plunked down in the middle?
I don't think for very long. They're going to move very quickly through these items. In the House, you can control the rules and the floor, what comes up and how it comes up, so they can move through these things quickly. But, of course, the Senate moves much more slowly, and once the president gives his speech on Wednesday night and you get the political reaction that occurs from Democrats and Republicans, that's really going to dominate discussion in the Senate and, frankly, discussion throughout the entire country. And so the attempt by Democrats to control the message, some of the messages they tried to send in the 2006 campaign, are likely to be sidetracked for a while.
John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and a columnist for The Wall Street Journal and a guest here on Here and Now. We appreciate it, John. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And just ahead, a military expert says the solution in Iraq, arrest more Iraqis. Bing West says 1 in 75 American males are in jail. He says only 1 in 450 Iraqis are. But is the solution fuller jails? Much more coming up here and now. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking Iraq. As we just heard, the new democratically controlled Congress begins a series of oversight hearings on the Iraq war this week, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said that future Iraq funding is not guaranteed. On Wednesday night, in a speech to the nation, President Bush will outline his plan to send an additional 20,000 U.S. troops to Iraq, the so-called surge. Well, joining us now on the phone is military expert Bing West. He's an author, former Marine, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He now runs a military consulting company. Bing, welcome.
Thank you.
And you co-wrote an opinion piece in today's Wall Street Journal that caught our eye. It's about how to change strategy in Iraq. And I want to just cut to the chase. You write, nothing will matter, not a surge, unless more Iraqis of both Sunni and Shia parties are arrested. You write, the core operational concepts have to be to neutralize criminals. Tell us more about that thinking.
Well, it's really very simple. These are killers that we're dealing with, and we have established, because of the reaction to Abu Ghraib on our side and because the Iraqis are totally incompetent on their side. A judicial system that releases 8 out of every 10 detainees.
In fact,
that's,
you described
nuts.
You described the impact on U.S. troops. Tell us some of the anecdotes about troops.
Our troop, I mean, you talked, I spent an awful lot of time over there with the different units, our units and Iraqi units, and I can go nowhere without the troops coming up to me and saying, this is insane. They call it the catch and release program, that they will detain someone, arrest him, send him up the chain of command, and within 6 weeks he'll be back out on the streets. And then, of course, he'll do what any criminal does. He'll go looking for the person who turned him in, knock that person off, and set everything back inside the city or the neighborhood for 6 to 8 months. And the troops are, this doesn't do anything for their morale, and they're pretty angry about it.
But, Bing, what are you saying? I mean, you write some interesting statistics that 1 in 75 American males is in jail compared to 1 in 450 Iraqi males. And as you write, you don't feel that Iraq is 6 times safer than the U.S., but that there's this sort of catch-and-release system that you describe. Some would say that one of the problems in the U.S. is that there are too many people just stuffed in jail. I mean, what would filling the jails in Iraq do to solve the problems in Iraq?
Well, it'd do the same thing it did in New York City. I mean, those who argue we have too many people in jail, just try telling the American people, let's open up the jails and let them walk free. I mean, we learned our lesson in the 1960s that basically the role of a policeman is not to be in rehabilitation. The role of the policeman is to get the criminal off the street.
We have a
system in Iraq where we are in Iraq doing what maybe some extreme liberals in the United States would do, which is release 8 out of every 10, and you can see the results. There's no deterrence to keep somebody from going out and killing again, and that's insane.
But can you compare a political struggle to crime?
Well, of course, because by political struggle, holy smokes, my definition is if you're cutting the heads off...
Bing? Oh...
And you are blowing innocents up. That isn't a political struggle. You're a murderer, and you should be you.
Oopsie.
My judgment, you should be executed.
Bing, I think you have an incoming call. We're hoping that interruption will go away because we want to ask you more.
Yep.
You also write that the as you call them, criminals in Iraq should be treated like the mafia. And you write that the plan to, for instance, use reconstruction money to offer them jobs won't work. Why?
For the same reason it wouldn't with the mafia here in the United States. If I walked up to a wise guy on the streets of New York, if I knew who he was, and said, hey, I got this great job for you, you can sweep the streets, he'd mock me. He'd say that guy's a Looney Tune. Once you are an embedded killer, and these people are embedded killers, the idea that they're going to be bought off by telling them they can sweep streets is preposterous.
These
people have to be hunted down. We know who many of them are, and unfortunately, you know, Prime Minister Maliki has put huge areas off limits, and that I don't think the president, I hope the president has told Maliki, if I'm going to surge American troops, we're going to be on the offense. We're not going to play defense and give the mafia half the city as a sanctuary.
Well, you're not the only one to make the criticism that it's not the number of Iraqis who are being arrested, but the kinds of Iraqis that are being pursued and arrested. They're largely Sunni. And you write that the Shia population that's part of the recent wave of violence should also be targeted and arrested. But is the Iraqi government, led by al-Maliki, going to cooperate with that?
Well, that's up to our president, isn't it? I would certainly hope that our president would say, hey, it's our guys over there dying, and as long as that's happening, we have an equal right to stand up and say, these are the kinds of leaders and these are the kinds of policies we expect, and I really hope the president does that and tells us he's doing it.
Well, you say the president has been afraid to play the game of blink with Nouri al-Maliki. What do you mean by that?
Well, I didn't mean afraid. What I meant was you look at this president and he keeps telling us, look, I'm a very strong-willed guy. I will not bend to the American public opinion. I will not bend to the Congress. I know what's right, and I'm going to go ahead and do it. I believe if he turned to Maliki and said the same thing, hey, listen, buddy, this is what you have to do, that Maliki would blink first and he'd say, holy smokes, I'm dealing with a very strong-willed president who knows exactly what he's going to do, and he is not going to send more American troops in there to play defense. If we know where these killers are, he's going to say, go get them, arrest them, and we're going to keep them in jail for the duration of this conflict.
Bing West is an author, a former Marine, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He now runs a military consulting company and wrote a provocative op-ed piece today in the Wall Street Journal saying that at the heart of the problem is in Iraq is that not enough of those perpetrating violent crime have been arrested. Bing, thanks so much for weighing in on a week of what's going to be a lot of debate and talk and opinion on what to do in Iraq. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for It's Here and Now. This year's inductees to the Baseball Hall of Fame will be announced tomorrow. There's always debate about who should get in, but that debate is reaching a new level this year because slugger Mark McGwire's name is on the ballot for the first time. Was he the greatest pure power hitter in baseball, or was he a steroid abuser? Something never proven, but suspected. Well, close to 600 baseball writers vote for the Hall of Fame, and a player needs to be named on 75% of the ballots to earn induction. So we've invited two writers to bat this around, and they've cast different ballots. Tim Kirkjian is with ESPN. Tim, welcome.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
Good. And Nick Cafardo with the Boston Globe. Welcome to you as well, Nick.
Hi, Robin. How you doing?
So how'd you vote, Tim?
I voted for Mark McGwire, and that was not an easy decision, believe me. And yet, I know I'm way in the minority on this. He might get 25% of the vote is my guess. I'm so far the minority is ridiculous.
But what was your one overriding compelling reason?
I just don't have enough proof about exactly what this guy did. Do I think he did steroids? Well, yes, I think he did. I know he did because he did androstenedione, which is a steroid. After that, we don't know enough. And in the absence of proof, I am voting for Mark McGwire. And please, Robin, don't tell me he doesn't have the numbers to get in because his numbers are Hall of Fame worthy. But people who add in the whole steroid dynamic, I mean, I really do understand the other side of the case. But in the absence of proof, I'm voting for Mark McGwire.
Well, Tim, rest assured, I'm not telling you anything because I don't know anything. Nick, you were the guy who voted against. Why?
Well, really, for the same reasons that Tim just articulated, I don't have enough proof on him, and I am suspicious of what he did, and until I have a real clear picture of Mark McGwire and a lot of people who played in that era, I'm going to withhold my vote. I agree with Tim that I think maybe a good 25% or so will vote for him. I don't think he'll get it. I think most of the voters feel the way I do, in that they would like to see more evidence.
Well, let's remind listeners who are thinking, what are you talking about? who aren't as passionately involved in this as so many baseball fans are. I've been on the blogs, and this is just such a big point of debate. But for those who only hazily remember, Mark McGwire, he had that big home run battle with Sammy Sosa in the late 90s. Tim, tell us more about, who he is.
He is one of the great sluggers in the history of baseball, and he basically was from the day he got to the big leagues. He had 49 home runs his rookie year. He slugged .618 that year. Reggie Jackson never slugged .618 in any season of his career and made it to the Hall of Fame on the first ballot, of course, without steroid accusations. He's been one of the great power hitters in the history of the game for a long time. He was injured an awful lot in the middle of his career. Then he got healthy. People say it's because of the steroids that he got healthy, and that's a fair point, perhaps. And from there on, he became basically the greatest home run hitter we've seen since Babe Ruth for about a five-year period there. It was unbelievable the things he did, starting with 1998 when he hit 70 home runs. So we were looking at a guy who made the All-Century team. I don't think he belonged on it, by the way, but the All-Century team named 50 players, two first basemen in the history of baseball, Lou Gehrig and Mark McGwire on the All-Century team. I have a hard time keeping that guy out of the Hall of Fame. I have to vote for him.
And that's Tim from ESPN votes for Mark McGwire. Nick from the Boston Globe, you voted against. What do you say to the people who say, but wait a second, this is the era. This is just the era we're in. And, if just a suspicion of steroid abuse is not going to play her out, then for the next 10 years, no one's going to be able to get in. What do you say to that?
Well, I've been down that road, too. And for a while there, I was saying the same type of thing. Well, this was the era of steroid use. Perhaps Jose Canseco was correct when he said that about 80% of the players took steroids in this era, and I really have no reason to doubt that.
Canseco, who wrote a book accusing many of doing it with him.
Right, and he's kind of the guy who brought everything to light here. And, in fact, I think in his book wrote that he injected Mark McGwire with steroids. So that's a valid point. However, I just keep coming back to the point that, taking steroids is illegal in this country.
But was it when he allegedly took them? I mean, that's the other debate, that in 98, 97, 99, they weren't illegal.
Well, they've always been illegal. I mean, there was no rule per se in baseball, condemning steroid use, but in society, they're illegal unless you have a prescription for them. So that to me overrides any baseball rule. And so that's where I keep falling back to, is that he may have, and I stress may have, taken something illegally to enhance his performance.
Tim, how has Mark McGwire helped or hurt this cause of getting into the Hall of Fame in the years after that home run slugfest? I mean, he testified before Congress, and then you feel like, maybe I wouldn't be seeing him anyway, but yeah, you just feel like you haven't heard from him. Has he helped or hurt his cause?
Well, he's hurt his cause. His appearance before Congress is one reason why he's going to get 25 or so percent of the vote.
Only.
Because he should have either not shown up or he should have shown up and answered the question. And if I were his advisor, I would have said, look, I did androstenedione. It's a steroid. It was an over-the-counter, and nobody told me I wasn't allowed to take it. I took it because I couldn't stay healthy, I couldn't stay on the field, and by not being healthy, I couldn't help my team. When I finally started using it, I got healthy, I helped my team, and then when I was told it was illegal, I stopped doing it. You shouldn't do it. Nobody should do it. That's what he should have said.
Where were you?
He would have gotten off a lot better than not answering the questions at all, because he came across so poorly that's one reason why he's going to lose so many votes in this election.
Well, you that sounded like a perfect script, but unfortunately, as you said, you weren't around to write it for him. Nick, I'm just wondering, here we are, this is what we're talking about. How much is this, really tainting tomorrow's Hall of Fame announcements? I mean, there's other guys going in, I'm sure, and they're getting completely overshadowed.
I'm not sure they'll get overshadowed. I think what's happening here is that the guys who are perceived as clean will be the guys who will be celebrated. Even here in Boston, for instance, Jim Rice's candidacy is gaining steam because he was perceived as a clean player, a guy who did it the natural way. And so people in the country, I think, will celebrate the players who are perceived as clean players.
Tim, what are some of the other names that might pop up tomorrow?
Cal Ripken and Tony Gwynn are going to go in on the first ballot with at least 90% of the vote. There's no question about that, nor should there be a question about that. And I agree with Nick. Even though a slightly bigger story will be McGwire not making it, I think everyone else will look at the other two guys and say, hey, those are first ballot Hall of Famers. We need to celebrate their careers also. Some of it will be taken away because of the attention on McGwire, but again, this is not going to be a surprise when Mark McGwire doesn't make it, and therefore no one should look at it that way, and it shouldn't be the biggest story in the world, because we already know he's not going to make it.
Tim Kirkjian, senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. Nick Cafardo, he writes for the Boston Globe. They're both weighing in on the Baseball Hall of Fame's class of 2007. They'll be announced tomorrow. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, not far from the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, you'll find the International Boxing Hall of Fame in Canastota. Inductees include household names like Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. But boxing is mostly a hidden world, and by definition, a brutal one. Producer Charles Lane attended a match in New York and sent us this audio postcard.
This sport is it's a beautiful sport. It's big-time repetition. You repeat and you repeat and you form, just like you want to break bad habits, you want to form good habits by repeating, repeating, repeating. My name is Bob Jackson. I'm 69 years old, and I've been in boxing since I was 17. When you come down to it, it's a sport where you get two men in the ring, nearly naked, bare essentials, and they're pitted against each other in a contest of who can dominate.
All right, listen up, guys. You're fighting tomorrow night. I think, Sal, what time are you starting your show? 7:30?
7:30.
All right, we want everybody in the dressing rooms at 5:30, okay? Now, once the event starts, you know who's in charge? The ref, the judges, and the doctors.
Okay, first thing we're going to start with, and since you're fighting in New York for the first time, we'd like to make sure our boxes are very well taken care of. I'm going to administer a test. This test has nothing to do with you fighting tomorrow.
My name is Osric King. I'm a sports medicine physician and a ringside physician for the New York State Athletic Commission.
3, 8, 5, 9. 9, 5, 8, 3.
Okay. That's what I told you. Close your eyes. Concentrate, man.
It's something we use to kind of gauge how the fighter is doing over a span of their career. So as things start to accumulate in terms of any unfortunately, brain damage, we can kind of get a sense besides a slurred speech. And it gives us a way to just say to the athlete, look, you're at this point now where your score has went from 30 out of 30 to now 15 out of 30. We think this is enough.
My name is Derek Rossi. I'm 6'3", 245. Right now I'm undefeated, 12-0. I really do like being in the ring, fighting. Everything just comes to fruition when you get in that ring. And you have like almost an out-of-body experience because it's just, when you step out for a second and you're done with the fight and you look back, you're like, that didn't feel like me. That was in there. I can't believe I really did that. Yeah, we are doing physical damage to each other. I guess, you know, that's part of the business. There is violence.
My name is George Mitchell. I've been a cut man for the last 10 years, and I'm going to show you some of the stuff I use in the fight. This is basically what I use, I come out with. That's an ice cream scooper, right? This is very good at getting in the corners of the eye. Well, when I get hit, there's big swelling that happens. It's called the alien, where it starts swelling. I get right away on this because this is nice and big, and you're able to press it and move it away.
A little too much, Lucky!
Back in the days of the Romans and the gladiators or whatever, people are attracted to that.
Getting to meet the boxers, of course.
My name's Beth. We are here in New York to be ring girls for the fight tonight.
My name is Amanda, and I'm also going to be a ring girl tonight here in New York.
Miss Amanda is a Southern belle from North Carolina with gorgeous blonde hair, tall and thin, and absolutely beautiful tonight, love.
Then today some people, oh, it's too brutal, But yet they'll go out and watch a horror movie of somebody cutting somebody's fingers off and their heads and whatever. So it's all beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Boxing actually is like a ballet.
That guy was out!
Okay.
And you're looking at him. The referee had to tell you to go after him. Don't throw two punches and then jump up and down. This guy, he's got to go.
Right. A series of questions. And the guy that runs out of the answers is the guy that's going to get his ass whipped. No matter how much I try to teach him or how much this and that, when the bell rings, it's just him and the other guy. He's on his own. You get that feeling of how to face life. Not being a hanger-on or a do like he, the other guys do or whatever, but be an individual. It's great.
By technical knockout.
That boxing audio postcard came from Here and Now contributor Charles Lane. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. The cartoon Get Your War On was born in the petri dish of politics, satire, and the internet that made The Daily Show and The Onion primary news sources for a new generation. Just a few weeks after 9/11, David Reese, a bored temp and former philosophy major, started pasting together clip art. You know, those stock drawings that are used for employee handbooks and annual reports. He filled the dialogue bubbles with mock gangsta language, much of which the FCC won't allow us to read on the air, and emailed these results to a few friends when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. Well, 5 years later, the strip, Get Your War On, appears regularly in Rolling Stone and in various compilation books. A play adapted from the strip opens off-Broadway this week, and David Reese has stopped temping to devote himself to his art full-time, and he's here in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how did you come up with this clip art? For those who haven't seen the cartoons, I want them to know the world that we are about to be in. These characters with their unchanging expressions. Describe them.
Well, I deliberately sought out the world's most boring images because I wanted the strip visually to be as banal and as boring as possible. And my inspiration for that was growing up reading comics as a kid when I would go to the newspaper comics page and stumble upon Apartment 3G or Brenda Starr, all those really boring grown-up strips where it just looked like it was just people talking on the phone to each other. And those strips always struck me as so impossibly mature and sophisticated. I mean, they had to be because they were so boring to look at. And so I wanted to recreate that vibe. But instead of people talking about, I don't know, whatever Brenda Starr did all day or whatever was going on in Apartment 3G, I wanted the characters to be talking about the war on terrorism and all these feelings of anxiety that I had after 9/11.
What is the language about? Because they talk about it, but they talk about it in that sort of, you know, I'm down with the gangsta, you know, play a hater talk. But they've got ties on and they look, you know, very 50s. So what's with the language that they use?
I just thought profanity was really funny, and I really love the rhythm of coarse American vernacular language, and I thought in the fall of 2001 I wanted the comic strip to be really angry, and I wanted it to push back against this kind of weird pseudo-religious rhetoric coming out of the White House vis-a-vis the war on terrorism. So I figured cramming as much profanity into the comic as possible would be a really efficient way of discussing the war on terrorism.
And now begins the bleep fest, because let people know, you know, what they look and sound like. From the very first one, you know, it's got three panels. There's a guy standing by his desk looking at a book but talking on the phone. A guy sitting at a desk, one hand on a keyboard, looking at his computer. Here's their exchange. I'll just read through as well as I can. So the first guy says, and again he looks so corporate, and he says, "Oh yeah, Operation Enduring Freedom is in the house." The second guy responds, "Oh, yeah, Operation Enduring Our Freedom is in the blankety-blank house." Third guy, "Yes, Operation Enduring Our Freedom to bomb the living blank out of you is in the house." I'm thinking of the television show.
Just say it. I want to hear the words come out of your mouth.
Yes, and then we'll both be exiting through
right,
that door
yeah,
over
yeah,
there.
Yeah. It'll be worth it, though.
But how freeing for you was it to do these?
Well, when I first started the strip, it was about 2 days after we started Operation Enduring Freedom. So it was a really cathartic experience for me as a cartoonist, because I did have all these thoughts and emotions kind of swirling around in my gut, and I couldn't find their expression in American pop culture, which is understandable because it was only about 6 weeks after the terror attacks. Back then, there wasn't a lot of satire floating around, so I tried my hand at it.
Well, and you said that, you know, you weren't seeing it in the pop culture, but very soon we saw it in real life, because it's remarkable how much real traitors soon sounded like the speakers in your strip that, you know, I was just reading. Because I'm remembering the dialogue between the two Enron traitors that was caught on tape talking about poor Grandma
burn, baby,
Millie.
Burn, yeah, definitely.
In California, and, you know, now she wants her blankety blank money back for all the power you've charged. Well, I can't even. Right. I can't even. You know what? The Enron
they're
traders
worse
coverage
than me.
Is
they're
worse
than
you.
Me. See what a corrosive influence my comic had on the free market energy trading business?
Well, let's listen to another one. This is a conversation between, again, two men, one on the phone, another standing there, not doing anything. And they're talking about George Bush. I will again read. Man on the phone says, I can't get over how much George W. Bush is yearning for peace so bad. That guy is yearning for peace like a blank. Second guy, I know. When I see him on TV, I'm overcome by the colossal magnitude of his yearning. It's a little effeminate, frankly. First guy, if there was a worldwide yearn for peace off, would Bush win? Could he out-yearn for peace the Dalai Lama? Second guy, that depends. Can the Dalai Lama yearn for peace just enough to allow for a massive, unprovoked military strike? You know what I love there? The words fit a pattern of an exchange that two, you know, businessmen might have. But they're not the right words. They're like, I'm wondering if you picked up that pattern when you were an office temp.
I think when I was an office temp, I just picked up the pattern of my head slamming against the wall repeatedly. But I do try to make the strip read really conversationally. Like, I think one of the messages of the strip is life and death issues of war and peace don't have to be discussed in this kind of real rarefied language of the Council of Foreign Relations or something. And since we're all literally invested in these decisions, we should all be able to take part in these important conversations, and we should be able to do that with whatever language we use in our day-to-day life.
You've said that if John Kerry had won the 2004 elections, you would stop making Get Your War On, the strip. But is that really the role of a true social critic to be a partisan like that? I mean, some would say, oh, you could have had fodder.
Yeah, but see, the big thing is, the scandal is I'm not a true social critic. I mean, I kind of bumbled my way into this, and I never meant to be a professional political cartoonist, so I figured that was as good as an excuse as any to kind of get out of the game. But, you know, the people spoke, and I have my mandate, and so I can't stop yet. I have at least another 2 years, unless Bush is impeached. Then I can knock off early, go hang out with him in the ranch.
So an avowed, an unabashed partisan. Have you ever done anything about anything that you see that's positive happening in the war on terrorism? Or was, no, the face is scrunching up.
But I'm just trying to think. I'm sure in the hundreds of comics I've made in the last 5 years, one or two have squeaked through that had something positive to say. I was pretty happy when we found Saddam Hussein cowering in a hole, and I made some nice comics about that, and Rolling Stone ran one where I thanked the troops who found Saddam Hussein and suggested they run for president in 2004. I was kind of happy when Rumsfeld resigned. I made a nice strip about that with his picture, and it said, I miss hating him already. That was kind of a lament for a lost friend. But overall, I feel like the job of a political cartoonist is to kind of rain on everyone's parade if it's a parade about how exciting and fun going to war is, which means when you look back over the body of work, I look kind of like a real pessimistic jackass who never looks at the glass as half full, which isn't necessarily true. I just think that my job is not to join everyone in praising how half full the glass is.
David Reese, author of Get Your War On, Get Your War On, two compilations of his comic strips. By the way, the money from some of your panels goes where?
The author royalties from the Get Your War On books we donated to a group of Afghan D-miners working in western Afghanistan in the Herat province.
David Reese, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Get Your War On author David Reese. For more on his work and the play that opens this week, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.